Last time, on Appalachian Mysteria, testimony in the trial came to a close. The medical examiner who saw Alex's body testified that his throat had been cut with 7 movements in a sawing motion, and that though he walked 1.5 miles in the forest before his death, he probably did not have the strength left to make the cuts himself. The medical examiner for the defense disagreed, only citing 3 cuts, and noting that Alex lost less than 1 pint of blood, the amount taken during a voluntary blood donation. Megan testified that the day she and Alex went to High Rock, he had cut her, both on her back and her genitalia, and that she'd gone through with the ritual that day because she was afraid of him. On this episode, a stranger approaches Teresa in the courtroom, the verdict is finally delivered, and we hear from 2 jury members who reveal some of the discussion that took place behind closed doors. From Chromatic Media in the heart of Morgantown, West Virginia, this is Appalachian Mysteria, Season 2, Big Savage. Megan Schaefer was the last person to testify at her own trial. That was a Friday. That afternoon, Judge Struben instructed the jury to go home for the weekend, then return on Monday morning for closing arguments and deliberation. He admonished them not to read any news stories about the case and to stay off social media. Monday morning, the courtroom was as packed as ever, with a number of curious law enforcement officers in attendance. For the prosecution, Lisa Thayer Welch called Alex a young man with manners, referring to his gifting of the bird feeder to Diane Kenner. She discounted the testimony of Megan's friends. She said that Kristen Logsdon didn't offer anything, quote, clear-cut, that Danielle Foy gave conflicting testimony, and reminded the jury that Doug Widows seemed, quote, really afraid he was going to say the wrong thing on the witness stand. She said that the family's timeline suggested Alex had recovered from his suicidal depression and drug and alcohol abuse. She reminded them that Jay had cancer and that Alex had been stressed about that, citing Jay's claim that Alex had once called suicide selfish. She noted that Dr. Arden, the medical examiner for the defense, was paid to give his opinion and that Dr. Allen had more experience. She reminded the jury that Megan's statements had changed and that she had originally claimed there had been no sexual assault or coercion. She said that during the trial, Megan had been turning on and off various emotions. She closed by showing a photograph of Alex lying on the forest floor, tendrils of his hair pooling behind his head. After a 20-minute recess, Tully began closing arguments for the defense. He reminded the jury of Blackstone's ratio, better that 10 guilty men go free than 1 innocent suffer. He said that no one close to Alex seemed particularly surprised when they were told he had committed suicide, and that Stephen Moon had been quoted early in the investigation as saying, quote, it looks like he went up there to kill himself. He reminded the jury that Alex had already threatened to, quote, put a knife to my throat. He said that Tristan had already suggested that his previous car wreck was an attempted suicide, and that she told Frostburg State University counselors that she was afraid Alex would kill their parents in their sleep. He quotes Alex, via Robison, saying that his family, quote, deserved to starve to death in a pit of vipers. He raised Alex's supposed claim to be a messiah who needed apostles, and said Alex thought he was receiving messages from movies he watched. He referred to some of Alex's writing and internet searches of topics like Most Beautiful Suicide and Quantum Suicide, and said that the events of High Rock were just a culmination of all this. He said Megan was a victim of abuse who was afraid, injured, and still tried to protect Alex, even after everything that had happened. This, he said, indicated the emotional control that abusers sometimes have. When both sides had spoken, the judge spent a significant amount of time instructing the jury on the precise definitions of the possible charges, which were second-degree murder, manslaughter, and assisted suicide. In general, second-degree is intentional murder that was not premeditated. Manslaughter is a heat-of-the-passion murder that occurs after some significant provocation, and assisting suicide is just what it sounds like. The various charges made for a wide range of possible sentences. Assisted suicide would earn only about 1 year in prison. At the other end of the spectrum, suggested guidelines for second-degree murder are 12 to 20 years, but judges don't have to follow those guidelines. Teresa wrote the prosecuting attorney, Lisa Thayer Welch, about possible sentencing.
And what she responded with was, when Ms. Schaefer was charged, the maximum penalty was 30 years. It has since been increased to 40 years. The 30-year limit applies to Schaefer.
At 1:45 p.m., the jury retired to deliberate. With the jury gone and people milling about the courthouse, Teresa was approached by a man she did not know, who claimed to have information that he wanted to share with her. We'll be referring to him as Mr. Kravitz, though the name has been changed to protect anonymity. He provided her his card, then slipped away. Immediately afterward, the family of Alex Stevens all approached Teresa. They urged her to stay away from Mr. Kravitz. Tristan, Alex's sister, claimed that Alex had dated Kravitz's daughter years ago and said Kravitz was very much against the relationship. She said he had a personal grudge against Alex and the Stevens family. She said Kravitz used to give Alex a hard time and that he would harass him in the grave if he could. Since nothing about these relationships ever came up in court and Teresa's job was simply to report on the trial, she decided not to speak with Kravitz. We did speak with him, and we should preface this interview by noting that Kravitz was able to provide extensive documentation and evidence for the story he's about to tell. Because of this, and to protect the identity of his daughter, who was a minor at the time, we've allowed him to remain anonymous. As it turns out, Kravitz didn't just know Alex.
Did you have any experience with the Schaefer family? Did you know them?
I did. Got to know them through a local karate school and known them for years.
So you knew, like, not only Megan, but her extended family?
I did. She has a brother, an older brother, and her mom and dad. I found them to be just nice people. You know, the mom and dad were very supportive of their two kids, Megan and their son. They were just very polite, very, very outgoing kids. You know, they never saw any bit of trouble from them. You know, they weren't the type of kids that would be testing the waters of those age with smoking or drinking, any kind of behavior that wouldn't be appropriate for a young person. You just didn't see it out of those two kids. And their mom and dad, you know, they did a good job, in my opinion. Nice family.
So you had a really high opinion of Megan herself?
I did. She was a good girl. My daughter could, she went with her brother to one of their dances at his high school. I don't know, Megan could be like a little sister to my daughter. You know, they were just very close. She would have first met Megan at the karate school. And that martial arts school, it caters to kids, but they would get the kids involved. I remember one time we had a birthday party there for my daughter, and Megan helped with the birthday party. You know, just as a little girl, she would help organize things and keep everything on track.
How old was she then?
Oh, gosh. I'm trying to think. My daughter might have been maybe 10, possibly. So Megan would have been a little younger, maybe 8.
And she's organizing
your
birthday.
She was. She was there, and she did a really good job. She would help play games for the other kids, organize some of that. She would help with the food and the cake. And I remember she's wearing her gi. Yeah, she did a good job. She was mature in some ways, like that way, as far as communicating. She wasn't afraid to talk to older people or the kids.
As for Kravitz's experience with Alex, what Tristan had to say was half true, but the story he had to tell was directly related to why Alex had been removed from the Coast Guard in the first place. It may also be part of why the Stevens were so adamant that Teresa not speak with Kravitz.
My daughter was just starting high school at Mountain Ridge High School. While she was there, she thought about joining the jazz band. She played the drums. So during that time, she met Alexander Stevens, who also was in the jazz band.
And how old was she at this time?
13.
And he was how old?
Probably 17, 18 when he graduated, from what I understand. I don't know his birthday. So we had a 4 years age difference right there.
Kravitz's daughter said she wanted to date Alex, and he was not into this idea.
And I just was, no, we're not going to do that. I'm not going to have a dating relationship, whatever that means at that age anyhow. But I did all her friends that she would meet through school. I always said, bring them to the house. They're welcome to our house. You know, I'd like to meet them, get an idea who they are. And so I did allow that. You can't stop in school talking or anything. And I didn't try to do any such thing like that. But no, he wasn't going to come to our house and just hang out.
So did that stop the relationship?
I thought it did.
Kravitz would later learn that the relationship continued at school and elsewhere. As you know, Alex did leave for the Coast Guard right after graduating from high school. In October of that year, a family friend called and asked Kravitz to come over. They'd gotten to know each other because their daughters were close. The man had received a package from the Coast Guard.
He thought it was a school recruiting effort from the Coast Guard, so he opened it. But when he saw that, it wasn't for his daughter. It was actually for my daughter, sent by Alex Stevens.
When Kravitz showed up and was handed the package, he was only half joking when he asked his friend, "Should I sit down to look at this?" His friend just said, "Probably."
And what was the package?
He sent her a letter, and he sent her a G-string. It's kind of uncomfortable for me to even talk about, I guess. There was a letter then that we found after this, too, that he had sent her a letter and a pair of sweatpants, too. And he was going to come home for Thanksgiving and wanted her to wear the sweatpants and the G-string.
So after you found out about this package, did you contact any of his superiors at the Coast Guard Academy?
I did. I thought about it for a little while, and I did. I drafted a letter. I sent pictures of the G-string along with the original letter to the Commandant of the Coast Guard, but I sent the original G-string to the total Commandant of the Coast Guard.
So you sent lingerie to the Commandant?
I did. Yeah, I sent him a G-string. So I guess we could laugh about that, but, you know, my background and just as a father, too, that was inappropriate. And I remember reading or seeing who I would address these to. I remember at the time reading about Admiral Papp, who was the Admiral, the Commandant of the Coast Guard. He was a father, and if my memory's right, he had 3 or 4 daughters.
So you felt that he would understand?
No, I think he would very much understand. And if Captain O'Connor at the time, who was the Commandant of the Coast Guard Academy, if he's a parent, a son or a daughter, I think most men would look at that and understand that that's not appropriate. This isn't conduct that a future young officer should act like.
Alex had known Kravitz's daughter when they were both minors in high school. But at this point, Alex was legally an adult that seemed to be sexually propositioning a 15-year-old. Opinions on how serious this is probably vary depending on who you ask, but for the Coast Guard Academy, this was a serious issue.
I got a call from a Department of Defense Coast Guard investigator, said that they received this letter, and he wanted to know if he could send investigators out to speak with me and my daughter. He said it concerned them a great deal. If I had found out more information, that there was any additional issues that needed to be handled by law enforcement, I was considering that as well. And he asked me if I would hold off on that and let them investigate this. And I said, as long as you guys investigate it and look at it, I said, I will do that. I agreed to that. They came out extremely professional. They spent quite a bit of time talking to my daughter. They kind of thought that the G-string was the extent of this incident. But they were also going to leave, and they were going to go talk to some other people in Frostburg. And shortly later, they called me back and asked if they could come back to the house.
Did they uncover anything else that he had done that you didn't know about?
They did. I didn't know... So these are one of these things that a dad really doesn't want to know about their daughter, a young girl. You know, when they grow up and be adults and have their own relationships and families, that's one thing. But yeah, they did. They told me that there had been some sexual activities between my daughter and Alex Stevens.
Legally, this made the situation more serious. By Maryland law, individuals under the age of 16 cannot give consent for sexual activity. Kravitz's daughter was 15 when she received the letter from Alex Stevens, but the sexual activity had begun when she was 14. And had Kravitz chosen to bring the case to authorities, they could have charged Alex with statutory rape.
He was not expelled from the academy at that time, but I do know that they said that he was disciplined. I don't know what level of discipline, and that something would be put in his Coast Guard file. That's the only thing that they told me.
The following school year, when she was in 10th grade, Alex showed up at her high school.
Alex Stevens came home for, I don't know, maybe a short period of time, for whatever break they might have had, and went to the school. Whether he was there specifically to see my daughter, I don't know, but he saw my daughter there. They had some sort of a confrontation, and I remember I heard about it later. She told me, and then also a school administrator did, that he must have had words with her and grabbed a hold of her. It scared her. And she found the school administrator. She had been crying. And the administrator said he spoke with Alex Stevens and told him, you know, that's it. Don't come back to school. You don't go to school any longer. You're not to come back here anymore.
It seems like their relationship was complicated, at least to her. She did actually meet with Alex one more time, the last time. She met him at a fast food restaurant in an attempt to get some kind of closure for the relationship that she seemed to have a hard time processing.
This was a hard time for her too. And I think a lot of times when you get involved in things like this at that age, I don't think kids aren't made for that yet. And so she had a time, but she said she just wanted to talk to him and know, and I remember her telling this, I just wanted to know why he did what he did. So she never was clear on that.
This specific offense she mentions here seems to be the same one he wrote to her about that October. In a letter to her during that month, he writes, quote, I hate to bring this back up, and I apologize again and again for what happened at the beginning of the summer. I know I've told you every time I can, but I just want to say that every day I regret the hurt that I caused you. I know how painful it was for you, and I don't even begin to know how to make it up to you. The greatest mistake of my life thus far just had to be the worst thing I've ever done to you. Again, I'm sorry from the bottom of my heart. Unquote. Kravitz provided extensive documentation, as we mentioned, to back up his stories, correspondence with the Coast Guard, postmark envelopes, a photograph of the G-string, a letter from Alex including sexual details. We were able to verify all of this, and it's the only reason we were willing to let him remain anonymous. It was hard to decide whether to publish all this because it does not seem to have direct bearing on what happened at High Rock. In the end, we decided that it was relevant to our story for two reasons. Number one, if Alex's expulsion from the Coast Guard is what precipitated his downward emotional spiral, this is pertinent information. It means that when his trial for sexual misconduct happened, the investigation surrounding Kravitz's daughter was already in his file. Without that record, he may not have been disenrolled for what appeared to be a drunken mistake, groping another cadet in her sleep. The other reason it's relevant is Tully's decision not to call Kravitz in court to speak about his experiences with Megan or Alex.
Trial had just started, or was close to starting. He and I had a pretty lengthy talk. I had already sent this to his office, everything that I had. I sent it to his office. They said they would give it to him. So he glanced at it, and we talked, and he was going to look at it later that evening. And he said he was going to probably use me as a witness to come and testify. He contacted me and said the trial went really fast, and they were about ready to do closing arguments, so he wouldn't be calling me.
So he didn't even want you as a victim impact statement?
No, he never mentioned anything like that. I left after they did their closing arguments. He and I spoke briefly at the courthouse, and I said, if you need anything further, just please call me. You know, I'd be happy to even speak for Megan if you needed that, or the family, whichever.
Why did you feel it was important to contact us?
I was reading the paper through this time period, and it was the Online Reporter. And as I was reading that article, it just, to me, they seemed to be very slanted. Just the one party in this incident toward Mr. Stevens. And maybe I missed some articles, but I didn't see a lot mentioned about Megan Schaefer.
We should say here that Teresa did try to interview Megan's family more than once, but they opted not to speak with her. The fact that Jay Stevens reached out to her with information about Alex probably explains any disparity in the information provided about the two in the public eye.
So I, myself, with my background, I didn't think that that was a thorough, complete, factual picture, or just a picture of this whole thing. Listen, this whole incident is bad for both families. Wouldn't wish it on anybody. But I think after listening to things in those closing arguments and things that I had never heard of, there's no doubt what I thought earlier, this is my opinion, that he was a troubled young man. I don't know what happened that night, but the Megan I know, and I mean, it just shocks me. I don't see her, somebody that thought this out and planned this. I mean, anything's probably possible, I suppose, but I just didn't see it.
And why is your anonymity important to you while you're talking to us?
For my daughter, she was young. Probably wouldn't want her name out there to know that this was part of her past either. You know, and that's been a hard decision for me too, to talk about this because of her. It's not to bring up any bad past or anything like that. It was, I weighed this. Do I not speak up? And it's like, I don't know. Hopefully I'm some sort of a good advocate for the Schaefer family. That's my intention.
I can tell this isn't easy for you to talk about.
It's not easy. I don't like to revisit it. I don't like it at all.
The jury recessed and you had no idea when they were going to come back. And there was rumor that the doors of the courthouse were going to close. And if you left, you wouldn't be allowed to get back in. So a lot of us stayed there for a couple hours. We didn't know how long we would be there. It was pushing dinner time. Everybody was hungry. There's really nothing to eat other than a little vending machine in the courthouse. There were people sitting on the floors throughout the courthouse, just everybody just waiting, wondering what was going to happen, when it was going to happen. After we hit about hour two, I didn't expect us to get to a verdict that night. At a certain point, one of the court officials said, "You know what? You can go out if you need to get something to eat." So I did. I was starving, and I went and I got some French fries. And I think I was only gone about 15 minutes. And as soon as I walked through the front doors, the bailiff at the door said, "You want to get up to the courtroom immediately." And he like rushed me through the security thing, and I ran up the stairs. And sure enough, the jury was coming back in, and they were getting ready to deliver the verdict.
The courtroom was less crowded now, as many people had left during the hours that had elapsed. Perhaps a couple dozen people remained. The families and friends of both Megan and Alex were certainly there as Judge Struben reconvened the proceedings. Everyone took their places, and the jury was instructed to read their individual verdicts aloud for the charge of second-degree murder. Juror number 1, guilty. Juror number 2, guilty. Juror number 3, guilty. Juror number 4.
Megan stood straight and looked at each one as they said what they said. And she didn't show any emotion until about the third one from the last. And then she started just shaking her head like, no.
Juror number 12, guilty. Months later, Sarah, Teresa, Jordan, and I all gathered in the same courtroom for the sentencing of Megan Schaefer. First, there were victim impact statements during which Alex's family was given the opportunity to express to the judge what his loss had meant to their lives. They asked to play a video of Alex singing in the Coast Guard. The court breaks and reconvenes several times as staff try to get the television to play a YouTube clip. "I desperately want to see this," the judge says at one point to no one in particular. A half hour goes by before the video is finally ready to play.
"I'm sailing away. Set an open course for the virgin sea. 'Cause I've got to be free. Free to face the life that's ahead of me.
Jay, at this point, said Alex would have had 50 more years of life, and I felt like a lot of what went into the discussion prior to the sentencing was all about time periods, you know, trying to justify how much time she should get.
I think what was important to me was that Struben was very articulate in discussing about his feelings regarding Megan, saying that she was no less remarkable, that she was a 4.0 student, that she was working on her degree. She was an industrious person, worked full-time hours. She had karate, a black belt in karate. She was teaching, and she excelled at everything she attempted to do. And he said that it wasn't fair to try and look at this trial and get closure because, quote, "Closure is the cruelest word in English language," end quote. And he told Megan's parents, "At the end of this nightmare, your daughter will be restored to you." But the same was not for the Stevens family.
Yeah, Struben was, he was very thoughtful. And he wanted everybody to know he was very thoughtful. He gave great consideration to both of these families. He acknowledged loss. Both of these families would have to face and deal with. He talked of two young lives being lost. He talked of both Megan and Alex having promising futures, coming from good families. He called the circumstances surrounding the death freakishly outlandish and gruesome.
There, at this point, while we're listening to him deliver this soliloquy, there are some sirens going outside, too.
Yeah, that was weird.
It was almost like
symbolic.
We were watching a movie, and this was, yeah, symbolism in this movie. And Megan was kind of shaking, and she looked like she was crying at that point.
For real crying.
Yeah, absolutely. But Struben was really adamant. He said, "I want to do the right thing." And he wanted to make sense out of the senseless. And he didn't know how to be fair when nothing was fair. And he didn't know how to make it right when it was inherently wrong. And he said to all of us, as he was discussing the sentencing, "Remember that I did the best I could." And I feel like he said that because most of the cases that go through that office are not murder cases. They're land cases or they're lawsuits.
None of the cases that go through that office are murder cases.
Right. And he knew that we would be talking about this and probably for years to come. And he wanted us to know that he, in his heart, felt that he did the best that he could.
Yeah, he didn't really show emotion when he said all of this stuff, but his words were definitely very emotional. But he also just laid out the facts, and he said point blank, she could have walked away.
He dwelled on this point a bit, pointing out that Megan could have escaped the situation when she was gathering things at her house with her mother, while Alex was getting the dog from his parents' house. When he got out of the car to leave the dog in the cemetery, or when she was following him to High Rock in her own car.
He said, the community will not tolerate this type of behavior.
He also said that Schaefer imposed a death sentence on Alex Stevens and a life sentence on the Stevens family.
At one point, he mentioned that these two were best friends and that none of it made sense to him because they both went into the woods and only one of them came back.
After this lengthy prequel, Judge Struben sentenced Megan Schaefer to the maximum possible time in prison, 30 years.
I asked Janet Stevens, Alex's mom, what he would say once all of this was finally over. And she looked at me and she said, Alex would say, don't stop living for me.
The juror selection for the trial had required dismissing quite a few people who were originally called for jury duty, and the transcripts from that day show just how small the community really is. Juror number 12 said, Mr. Stevens' mother and I are cousins, and was dismissed. Juror number 23 said, a couple of months ago I was at my hairdresser, and the victim's immediate family member was there and was talking about it quite a bit. Dismissed. Number 47 said, my daughter-in-law works with the person who was killed, and was dismissed. Number 55 was dismissed because they had worked with the victim's father, Jay Stevens, as an emergency official on ambulance calls. Juror number 60 was dismissed because they worked with vital records for the health department and said they had, quote, actually seen the death certificate and couldn't be impartial. When Struben asked juror number 59 why she should be excluded from the process, she told him, I'm married to you. Of the 12 jurors that were finally selected to serve during the trial of Megan Schaefer, we were able to speak with two, who gave us insight on what went on behind the deliberation room doors.
So you'd read the articles, and surely you had some questions going in that you were hoping would be answered throughout the trial. Were there any big questions answered for you?
Probably more questions at the end than anything.
There are still more questions than answers. As far as evidence, we saw pictures of his apartment. We saw pictures of the knives in his drawer.
And the bag of clothes.
We saw pictures of his car that evening and how the door of the car was still open, the radio was still going. There was still a box on the front seat. We saw that, and then we saw a movie of her lifting weights, which was to show us that she was a black belt. And then we saw pictures of Alex after she had cut him with a knife.
There were also some pieces of evidence they didn't see that they would have liked to.
They didn't take pictures of the cliff where they jumped off. They were more concerned about the items in the area.
This made it hard for them to paint a mental picture of the cliff or what the fall might have looked like. These two jurors confirmed our suspicions about the two things that hurt Megan's case the most. The first, as we talked about last episode, was her demeanor on the stand.
The person that was on the stand that was did the most damage to herself was Megan herself. It was so obvious when she was being questioned. Her emotions just changed from one extreme to another. She could cry, and then she would change and be normal. And it was so fakey and obvious. And I think I know for myself, it was just so damaging to her, because I knew from that point forward that anything she said, we didn't know if it was true or not. And in the end, when she left the stand, she kind of, I don't know if it was a smirk that she gave to her parents, like, I did good.
Yeah, the hard part is trying to figure out someone's personality, whether they were trustworthy, how much credit you could put on one side or the other. And so we just get like this short amount of time to put a lot of into that character witness. It was pretty tough, but I'll agree with her. The emotions turning on and off, no tears, even though she was just completely, bawling. But when they did read the verdict, she did have tears.
So that solidified your opinion?
A little bit, yeah. I mean, you never want to see somebody go through that.
And coloring these observations, of course, was the fact that Megan's story had not remained consistent.
Something like that, I know you would be, you'd have a hard time remembering all the facts, when you go through something traumatic like that, even if you were, it was intentional. Like it should be, some of that stuff should be ingrained.
The other major problem for Megan were the medical examiners.
How did you go into thinking about whether she was guilty or not when you heard one person say it is impossible for her to do it and another person say it is absolutely possible for him to have done this to himself?
Well, it was brought up that he has done a lot of court appearances where he looked at cases, not actually seen the physical body, but just looking at the pictures, and he gets paid basically to show up and give his opinion on a lot of these, as opposed to the other medical examiner that actually physically was there, saw, in detail what had happened. And I believe that she had seen a lot more than him as well. Mm-hmm. And so I put a lot more trust. She seemed more trustworthy as her character as well.
We asked the jurors what they thought of the lawyers who tried this case. And they said this, starting with Megan's lawyer, Tully.
I think he did an inadequate job of defending her. If her back was really scarred, he would have showed us a picture.
He continued to say that, or it's not his position to show that that she didn't do it, that the prosecution had to show that she did do it. And he kept on mentioning that. So that kind of, surprised me a little bit, because even though that's true, he should have brought a little more, like you mentioned, a few more things to light if they were true. Lisa Welch, she did a pretty decent job, but there was still a lot of questions that were still left unanswered that,
And the jurors, we would sit there and think, why didn't she ask this? Why didn't they ask this? We're common everyday people, and we are questioning things that should have been brought up that weren't.
Mm-hmm. I guess the bank account was, or the beneficiary portion was one, because that wasn't really brought up, or the amount, because the amount of money definitely plays into, a murder perhaps, or homicide.
He only knew her for a short while. I think it was only a matter of 3 months that they even knew each other. I don't know. I still don't understand why he would name her as beneficiary. Why didn't he name Tristan as beneficiary? It just doesn't make sense.
Between the confusing evidence in the case, the lack of a proposed motive, and the facts they felt were being left out, the jurors say they were required to simply imagine what might have happened at High Rock that night.
We had to create the scenario ourselves. We didn't have anybody honest that we could get facts from. We had to put it together ourselves. It was a lot of speculation on our part, because we couldn't believe anything that she said. It is questionable that somebody would pour motor oil over their vehicle, but why would he leave the door open in the car and the radio going, and why were some items taken up to the rock and others were left in the car? I don't know.
So what were some of the scenarios that you discussed with the other jurors?
I guess the different scenarios of whether they fell, push, pull, walk down. He had broken ribs, but I believe, right?
Mm-hmm.
That could have been dealt with a karate kick, she kicked him off and he grabbed her and they, you know, fell off, or maybe they walked around and something else happened.
I don't think they did jump. I think they walked down. I think his intentions were to get back to the car because he still had items in the car that he didn't take with him. And I don't think he would have done that to his pets. I think he could have let the dog go. He could have killed the dog. But the fact that it was still in a cage, and the same with the cat, I think if they would have jumped 30 or 40 feet, they both would have had a lot more physical damages to their bodies than they did. He had some bruises on his back, but his back looked pretty flawless.
Mm-hmm.
That if they jumped that far, there would have been a lot more damage. I think they walked down.
The scenarios of the knife, you know, when they fell, she had the knife and she felt scared. Why, you know, it was dark. He didn't have his glasses. She could have thrown it. She was way more, she was a lot stronger than him. I mean, she definitely could have overpowered him without any kind of knife.
They took a picture of all his knives in the drawer, and they were Emerald Lagasse knives, and they all had their sheaths on. They were all perfectly placed in the drawer next to each other. So obviously he took care of those knives. But yet, when the knife was taken that night, the sheath was left in the drawer, which didn't make a lot of sense. If he liked those knives so much, why would he take the knife without the sheath? It made me wonder if she took it.
And another scenario that played out in my mind was, you know, maybe she was tired of, if there was a situation where he was mentally abusive or, you know, what have you, and she finally snapped, you know, she just wanted to get rid of him. And that, you know, there's a lot of frustration into cutting someone's neck half, you know, head out halfway off. If it's a suicide, why continue cut? Like, I mean, the pictures that we saw were extremely gruesome. Without getting too graphic, it was probably halfway through his neck. A suicide, slice, you're done. You know, when, you know, you're getting down into lots of muscle and, you know, I guess it was actually into the bone a little bit as well. Like, there's got to be some anger build up, or, you know, she's actually trying to make sure something's, you know, he's not going to come back from. But, I mean, that was extremely gruesome. Somebody knew what they were doing.
We were surprised. I was surprised when the toxicology report didn't show any drugs in their systems.
Quick side note here, the jurors may not have known that standard toxicology reports don't usually test for hallucinogens like LSD.
Because it was hard for me to identify with that mindset. Why were they doing that night? If it was supposed to be assisted, and they were both doing really bizarre things, it made me wonder, was she wanting to commit suicide too? Was that the pact that they had, and she didn't want to go through with it?
The jurors say that the story of Diane Kenner, who was visited by a lost, disheveled Alex a week before High Rock, confused them as much as it did us.
So again, you know, more questions than anything else.
Now, they had mentioned in the interviews, and I'm wondering if you saw in the evidence, that he had spray-painted a symbol at High Rock. Did you guys see any photos of that?
I think we did, but I don't remember what the symbol was. It wasn't something I was familiar with.
We're very curious as to what that is. But they also asked Megan if she knew that he had carved it into his hands and feet. Did you see that in the photos you saw of him?
No.
Yeah, we went over the body pretty well to see what the bruises and the scratching from, you know, because when we were looking for the fall damage. But yeah, I don't remember seeing those unless it was just very light scrapes or, you know, nothing deep that would scar.
Just another talking about carving that we have no evidence of.
Finally, we asked the jurors to summarize as best they could why they chose the charge of second-degree murder and why they believed Megan was guilty.
He couldn't have done that to himself. You know, whatever led up to the scenario, no matter what happened beforehand, there's no way he could have done that to himself. And she didn't mention anybody else but her being there. So she had to have done it.
We could have deliberated within an hour. We could have had a verdict in an hour. There was one person on the jury that got hung up on one word. We decided to take one last vote. And then it was at that time that we all agreed. But I think it was like 3 hours later.
Right. Yeah. I mean, we could have talked about all the details all day. But when it really came down to facts and looking at that damage, there's no way he could have done that to himself.
So it didn't really matter to you about the motive. It was just in that situation, it was pretty clear cut to you?
I mean, I guess it played some part into it. I mean, you kind of have to throw the details into it. But at the same time, yeah, the hard evidence was there.
Mm-hmm. It was the bottom line.
Yeah.
That she did it there. And then all the other details made you have more questions.
It's hard to think that a human being would, whatever the case may be, even if it was, say, it was assisted suicide and it just went real too long or whatever, someone shouldn't be able to do that to somebody else. Like, what's your mindset? Like, that's a human life.
The jurors, several of them, we'd go home at night and cry. When I, a week after the trial, 2 weeks after the trial, when I go home at night, I have to drive up Alder Street, and it was hard for me to look at the courthouse. It was one of the most bizarre stories I've ever heard.
And the bad thing is we'll probably never know. There's only one person that really knows what happened.
Mm-hmm. It's so frustrating, too.
It was extremely frustrating for us.
We had made a list of questions that we wanted to try and address in the podcast, and I think we've just added more to it since then.
I sit here and I can't even believe I'm having this conversation right now, because it's just, it, to me, in my mind, it's just not possible. Like, none of how they're portraying all of this, there's something missing.
This is Jonna Harvey, one of the friends we interviewed in episode 2, when we also interviewed Michelle Ingrody.
It's just something that seems so far-fetched for me and so not like, real.
We want justice. We got justice. Now let's move on from it. You know what I mean? Like, they got a verdict. This is what happened in court. She showed no emotion. She did it. Let's move on. Sorry, she's doing 30 years for it, but we have justice, you know? And at the same time, I'm like, how can you even think that that's justice for him? If it was the other way around, I would want to know truly and without a doubt what happened and why it happened the way it did.
Kind of from the beginning, we were like, she's never going to win with this lawyer in this county.
I don't have any idea why they would have court in Garrett County. I feel that it should have been somewhere else. I thought, if anything, she was going to get assisting a suicide. That's the only thing that would really make as much sense.
I feel like whatever he was into, she was either going along with it, maybe in hopes that she could convince him to get out of it, or she didn't know how to stop.
People do shit that they, you know, and get in relationships and turn into people or change themselves for people. And it takes a lot of growth to not do that. And she's young. I mean, she just turned 21. One night I asked her, you know, we were doing floor sets or something, and I kind of asked her about the whole night. And she told me what she remembered, but she didn't really remember anything. And she showed me some scars and stuff. And this had to be August, September-ish.
So this is right before she got arrested.
Jonna says that the night she finally asked Megan what happened at High Rock, she too saw cutting scars in Megan's skin. But the scars she saw were on Megan's abdomen.
She said that she was carved, you know what I mean? And I don't know exactly, I guess it was, I don't know if it was a pentagram, like the star and the circle. I don't know direct terms for that kind of stuff. But you could tell that she had like triangular still scars on her stomach. And then of course she told me about the whole cutting of her genitalia, you know what I mean? Of course I didn't see that, but she did tell me about it. You could tell she was depressed and she was almost publicly shamed. You know what I mean? Like something that you don't really want to speak about, but at the same time, like you eventually have to speak to someone.
Megan has filed for an appeal, but as of this publication, no court dates have been set related to that. She's not replied to either of two letters we sent to her, so we're unsure that she's actually received them. A friend of Megan's claims to have mentioned Big Savage to her, but she supposedly said that the only way she'd ever talk to us is to receive full transcripts of the show to review first. We were not the only media source that had reporters at Megan's trial. Dateline NBC had a scout there to report back about whether the death of Alexander Stevens would be a good story to cover. As I was talking to that reporter while the jury was deliberating, I could tell that they weren't going to cover it. Dateline likes neat, conclusive stories with revelations that eventually make everything clear, packageable. We've talked to a dozen or more people about this case, and no matter what they believe might have happened, everyone seems to agree that almost nothing makes sense, that there's only one person who truly knows what happened that night. I confess that after spending so much time and energy on a project like this, it would feel rewarding for some clear narrative to emerge as the absolute truth. But in a case where even the jury can't seem to determine exactly what happened or why, it seems as though the absolute truth may remain hidden in the Appalachian fog that so often makes a home in the mountains of Savage River Forest. Appalachian Mysteria is a Chromatic Media production. It was produced by myself and Sarah James McLaughlin with lots of assistance from our co-host, Teresa McMinn, and courtroom reporting by Jordan Carter. If you find yourself liking the show, take 2 seconds to rate it on your podcasting service. It makes a difference in helping others to find good stuff. If you haven't listened to Season 1 of Appalachian Mysteria about the WVU co-ed murders, make sure to check that out as well. The music for this show was written and recorded in Morgantown, West Virginia by John Smithers, Nick Larson, Annie Stroud, and Nathan Snyder. You can connect with us and others about the case and view updates as any become available at the Big Savage Facebook page. You can follow Chromatic Media on Facebook, Instagram, or on the web at chromatic.media. That's K-R-O-M-A-T-I-C.media. Take care.